Good morning, I'm Jeff Robinson, and this is City Views. It's not hard to see why Radiolab has become a public radio phenomenon. The program produced by WNYC has received wide acclaim for its extraordinary creativity and ability to take difficult scientific concepts and not only make them understandable, but also fun. It's grown so popular that hosts Jed Abumrad and Robert Krulwich have even taken it on the road, performing before sold-out live audiences, which they'll do this Wednesday and Thursday at Salt Lake City's Capitol Theater. But before that, they'll speak tomorrow night at the new Natural History Museum of Utah as part of its Nature of Things lecture series, speaking on making tricky science into sticky stories, to give us a peek into what they'll have to say and what goes into making Radiolab the successful program that it is. I'm joined now by both Jed Abumrad and Robert Krulwich from the studios of WNYC. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, are you sure we're as successful as you think we are? Have we sold out? Because I don't think we sold out. I think people who listen to this can come and get a chair.
We are
darn
close,
that's right.
But
yeah.
Yes, there are
that's
tickets.
That's right, but you have sold out in the past, I believe.
Yes, we have.
Yeah, every show that we've done so far.
Right.
All right,
so
very
we
good.
Don't want to be disappointed, Salt Lake.
And tickets for that will be available at arttix.org. We should mention the Nature of Things talk, I believe. Reservations are full, but you can catch the live broadcast here on KCBW. Well, I want to start off by having each of you tell us about how you got into radio journalism, because you both started off on pretty divergent career paths. Jad, let's begin with you. You initially set off to be a composer, is that correct?
Yeah, I ever since I was 5 and all the way up to 18. When did you go to college? 18 when you go to college?
17, 18.
All the way up till maybe 18, 19, I was under the misguided impression that I would be a composer. Specifically, I would write music for films. That was always the idea I had in my head.
When you were 7?
Yes. Okay. I had that in my head from a very early age. Huh. I turned out to be very bad at that. And so I stopped doing that.
Does that mean, like, did you hum when you were in movies, thinking, actually, I would change the bass line there? What does that mean?
Write music for films? Well, you watch a movie and there's those moments, like those Bernard Herrmann-esque moments, yeah, that sweep the characters and make them 30 feet tall and amazing.
Yeah.
I wanted to be that guy.
I see.
I just wanted to make that music.
You were a weird 7-year-old.
It was Tennessee. I didn't have a whole lot to do, so I stayed in my room and
dreamed
big dreams. And it didn't work out. So I ended up, I was also sort of, I went to school for writing. And so at a certain point, a few years after not being a very good composer, I decided, well, you know, I could do something maybe that would be the sort of the middle point between writing and music. And I just chose radio. I wasn't a big radio listener. But I thought, this seems like an interesting middle ground. And so I started volunteering, and, you know, one thing led to another. And I know 12, 13, 14 years later, here I am.
I feel like I'm listening to a live edition of Radiolab here with this with this back
we
and forth.
We were just actually recording. We were recording the show just right before we got on with you. So
we're all warmed up.
All right.
So in my case, I was on the air really from even earlier than Jad. I was in radio in about 3 or 4, I'd say.
That would be 3 or 4 months pre-birth.
Well, no, because I would...
In utero, he was on the radio.
I would ball my hand into a fist, which was my idea of a microphone, and then I would narrate. So I would be in the tub, and there was in the faucet. The faucet had a little bit of chrome around it. So I'd sit in the tub, and the water was all around me, and I could see vaguely myself reflected in the faucet, and then I'd go on the air.
What would you broadcast about?
I would describe my day. You know, big day at the playground today. Went up to the slide. Can't quite do that yet, but I'm looking forward, maybe in the next year or two, to actually descending like Billy Theodore does every time. How does Billy Theodore do it? We'll be right back.
Live to the scene on the monkey bars.
No, I don't know where. There was no one in my family that was a broadcaster of any sort. My father imported hats. My mom had been a sailor, actually in the Navy, and then a housewife. And nobody was broadcasting anything but me. I kept doing it when I was in college. I would drive my bicycle back to the dorm, and I would say, I remember very specifically, as I rolled up the path, I said, Robert Krulwich is now arriving at the dormitory. Just a moment, we'll see if we can get a glimpse.
Well, Robert, as a national science correspondent, I kind of had always assumed your education was in, you know, biology or chemistry that you had, you know, studied. But I think you actually went to law school, if I don't have that wrong. How did
you transition
from that into science?
Slowly. Hmm. You see, I think when I was in law school, I realized that Everybody else was just a little faster than me. I wasn't like that I was dumb or anything. I just couldn't quite follow what everybody was saying. I was a bit of a slow processor. And in law school, they'll create fact situations that are just extra dense. I'm not sure why they do this, but instead of saying, what would happen if there was a crash and somebody in Utah bumped into somebody in South Dakota? Which court should we go to? The Utah court or the South Dakota court or whatever? Instead, they'll say, there's this fire engine, two Arabian legatees, one serving the city of Denver and the other serving the city of Salt Lake City, are in one car and crash sideways into a fire engine, throwing three firemen into Utah and the other three firemen into, I don't know, whatever's next door. And everybody else can follow this but me. I have to write a little cartoon of the firemen, and and I just would go slower than everyone. And what I discovered in law school is that I can only go slow. So that means that, and I married someone who goes really fast. In fact, one night, we were at the dinner table. This actually happened. And she turned to me. There was my brother-in-law and my father-in-law and her. And she said, do you mind if we talk abstractly for a moment, Robert?
I said,
what do you mean? I said, I can talk abstractly. I said, liberty, justice for all. That's abstraction. He goes, no. And then she turned to her father and they just started talking. They were using English words and everything, but I did not understand anything they said. So I am slower than others. And that's really the job.
So naturally you went to science where...
Yeah, I just went to hard places where you're allowed to talk slowly, because I think most people know very little really about history or politics, or very little about the law, or very little about economics, or very little about science. And so I guess one of the thoughts I've always had is it's not a bad thing to start at the beginning of a story rather than right in the middle. So much journalism, like if you're covering hockey, you don't say every night, this is a game played on ice wearing special shoes. You don't say that. You just start to say, today, this team beat that team by this many points. And I would actually like to have the lecture that says it skates and it begins with ice. How do they get the ice that cold anyway? That sort of thing. So that's what I do. And that's the category I seem to be in, whether it's law or whatever.
You're listening to City Views here on KCBW. My guests are Jad Abumrad and Robert Krolwich. They're co-hosts of Radio Lab. They'll be speaking tomorrow night at the Nature of Things lecture series, airing live here on KCBW, and performing Radio Lab in the Dark this Wednesday and Thursday at the Capitol Theater. Tickets for that available at arttix.org. And there's an interesting story behind how you two met and launched this show together. Jad, why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. Well, this was in that sort of wandering period I was describing earlier, where I didn't quite know what I was doing. I was hanging around this station, WNYC, and they were giving me odd jobs to do. And one of the jobs I was given was to march out into New York and interview a series of people who had been longtime supporters of the station, and have them, each of them read a 30-second bit of copy. One of whom I just remembered the other day was Andre Gregory from My Dinner with Andre. Mm-hmm. He was one of the guys on the list. In any case, there was a bunch of people who were his level of renown. Krolwich was at the bottom of the list, last guy that I went to talk to. And I essentially walked into his office at ABC, handed him the sheet. I didn't really know who he was, but he had a somewhat familiar voice. Mm. And, you know, on the sheet was some boring copy like, you know, I'm a proud member of WNYC. I believe public radio is very valuable and the fair and measured views, blah, 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 blah. So I handed him this thing. And he took it and was like, and in his eyes, he was like, you idiot, I'm not going to read this
I don't think I was calling you an idiot.
In fact, you rip it up and throw it into the air like confetti. But I know that didn't actually happen.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he takes it, he rewrites it on the spot, and writes it into some hilarious 30-second thing involving oil tycoons and alien cults and strange things that was way better than the original. And so at that moment, I was like, who is this guy? That was weird. None of the other people on the list had even bothered to even look at the words, but he somehow, in the blink of an eye, had made it from something completely ordinary to something great. So, I don't know, we got to talking at that point.
And, that's when I said, so who are you? And he said, well, I came to New York and I was working at a radio station called WBAI. And I went, it's a funny thing. That's the radio station I started at, WBAI. He said, yeah, then what do you do? Well, then I in doing this NPR thing. I said, well, you know, that's funny because that's where I, after BAI, I went to NPR too. He said, oh. He said, so where did you go to college? I went to college at Oberlin College in Ohio. I said, that's where I went to college. So I had this strange sense that this was a doppelganger-ish experience.
Yeah, it was like an echo or something.
Yeah.
25 years
so
later.
So then I said, let's go to lunch or breakfast or something. So we just began talking, and then that just seemed extremely easy.
Yeah, we would have breakfasts like every other week or something for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And we didn't, you know, that's how it all started for us. It was not like a professional thing. It was just like, mm-hmm. hey, let's have breakfast and compare notes. Yeah. And somewhere along the way, I started working on a show called Radiolab, which was a very different show at that point. He heard it. He was like, oh, it's kind of interesting. Let's just mess around.
No, I didn't think it was kind of interesting. I thought, this radio station in New York City, this public radio station, has a boy genius in it. The things that he was doing were so different from things that I had heard before. And I listen very keenly to these things. I'm always got a sort of radar up. And what I heard, just the way the sounds were being put together, it was words like usual, or almost like usual, mm-hmm. but there was some beat in it that was just different. And I looked at him and thought, you know, instead of me going blah, 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 in an advisory sort of way, I think I'm going to just jump on your lap and sit here for a while and see what I can take from you, because you are doing things really differently than everybody else. And there's something electric about the way you put words together. And that's, I think, where suddenly, instead of it being a old guy talks to a young guy thing, suddenly it was like, what can you do? And then the other was, and then we just had this partnership sort of.
Yeah. I mean, it was very like ad hoc for a long time. I mean, we would just experiment in the really early in the morning because we could never get studio time. So we'd show up at like 7:30 in the morning and hang out for 20 minutes and just mess around. You know, we'd have a clip of tape and we'd start to improvise. And, you know, later we'd make a little theatrical scenario and put sounds and weird stuff. And it kind of very quickly began to sound like Radiolab.
Yeah.
But we didn't quite know what it was for a very long time. And so it would exist as these small 5 to 10 minute experiments.
And so I want to play a clip here from an episode back in 2007, one of the first available in the podcast. It's called Who Am I? And this explores identity and that sort of a philosophical question that meshes with recent discoveries about the brain. So let's listen to this 40-second clip here from that episode.
When you ask the basic question, where is the self? The ancients had an answer, always the same answer. Right there. That's where the center of rational thought, speech, everything is.
Didn't they actually try and cut it open and see if it was living in there?
Yeah, and then they found out it was a pump, so they were really disappointed. So they began to gaze upward a bit, and here's the modern prejudice. V.S. Ramachandran is one of the world's great neurologists. If you ask him where the self lies, he'll tell you without any question it lies where you'd hear this.
And that is what?
That is the sound of a neuron firing.
It's astonishing that we've got 100 billion little wisps of jelly in your head called neurons, and it's the activities of these neurons, the flux of ions across them, the passage of current, that is life. You know, what we call our mental life.
So that episode is called Who Am I? From back in 2007. As you're listening to that clip, you know, has the feel of the show remained essentially the same in those years since, or how has it evolved over the years, Robert?
My phone always goes off in every... Did you hear that?
Was that in the clip, or was that...
Yes. Hey, was that your... Because my phone, I've turned it off, so that must have been... Was there a phone? Did you hear a phone in the clip?
I did. I'm not quite sure. We are wrapping up a pledge drive here, but I don't think we have microphones on the phones. I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, because if it was a phone right smack, that's very normal.
Yeah, that happens every recording session. Robert's phone just goes crazy. You know, the feel has remained consistent in some ways and not in others. I mean, it's funny to listen all the way back to that clip. I think that we roam around a lot more now, you know, and we just go into, we're, you know, we're, I think, in a particular place right now where we're just we want to sort of explore different neighborhoods. That's part of why we're doing this live show, is just to try completely weird and new things. But there is still, I think, underlying the entire thing from the beginning till now is the sense that here are two guys who like to hang out and chat and fight on occasion, but mostly just kind of think big thoughts together and then have adventures together.
And so when you're creating an episode of the show, I'm just really curious about the process that goes into that, because, I mean, the writing must take such effort when it comes to, you know, the fact that you're hearing one voice for 5 seconds and it switches voices constantly. I mean, how do you go about even starting an entire hour of such a program when there are so many elements that have to come together to pull it off?
Well, for one thing, we try not to script. So because we knew that our main competitor was This American Life and Ira Glass, and we thought, well, there's almost no way you can get around him. I mean, he's just so good in everything. But we thought, well, maybe since he's scripted, we should not be. But we had no idea how you do that, since we're always uncertain of what we're talking about, and we need to make sure that we're truthful and accurate on the facts and all. And writing it down would certainly help. Then you'd stay on script. But what we do is we write it down and then we improvise. So we write script and then we leave the script behind. So part of the craziness of doing this is we do it over and over and over again. So that's the performance.
Yeah.
Then there's the topics.
Yeah. And it's also like, you know, in terms of the way that the construction and you know, the fact that we use four voices overlapping in a kind of counterpoint. You know, I mean, that all happens in the edit, and the edits can be really arduous, and they take sometimes weeks. But really what we're doing, I feel like, is we're telling stories in very kind of classic once-upon-a-time fairy tale style. You know, I feel like the stories we tell, the way we tell them, are very old. I think what we end up doing is we end up applying a set of rhythms and a set of beats and a set of moods to those forms that perhaps feel a bit new, but I always feel like we're actually telling these kind of really bone simple stories on some level, you know?
Well, there is something about the way it's put together. I mean, maybe because Jad is the one really putting it together. I mean, there are, of course, we all contribute, but to an important degree, this is Jad's music that you're listening to. And how it gets agreed upon and how it gets made is still a pretty mysterious subject to me. I mean, I'll do all the things I'm told to do and all the things I feel like doing, and we'll argue in different musical modes. We'll argue passionately, we'll argue quieter. He'll give me musical instructions and say, take that down, and I know what he means, usually. And what he does with it all has been changing over time, but there is this, it's, as he says, everything we do is in service of the editorial mission of the story. So it's all about making it stick in your head and making it vivid.
Yeah.
As for the choice of the topics, that seems to be more Darwinian. I mean, we'll choose a story and then we'll choose another story and we'll hope for a third and a fourth. And at some point, the stories have to begin suggesting neighbors and friends and cousins and sequential stories. A show evolves, kind of. So we're working on now called Color. And this morning, we're just throwing different stories, which some of which we're well into, some of which we're just imagining. And you throw them and you see if one story invites another. And the shows come alive just that way.
Yeah.
You're listening to City Views here on KCBW. We'll be right back with more of our interview with Jad Abumrad and Robert Krulwich of Radiolab. This is City Views on KCBW. My guests are Jad Abumrad and Robert Krulwich, co-hosts of WNYC's Radio Lab. They'll be speaking tomorrow night at 7 at the Nature of Things Lecture Series at the Natural History Museum of Utah. It'll be broadcast live here on KCBW, and also performing Radio Lab in the Dark Wednesday and Thursday at the Capitol Theater. Tickets for that at arttix.org, and we'll be talking about that live performance coming up in just a couple of minutes here. I want to set up another clip here, and I'm 75% sure this one will not have a phone ring in the background. This is mathematician Steve Strogatz from Season 5, Episode 5, The Wonder of Youth, talking about what the moment of discovery feels like. He's plotting points on graph paper, charting the arc of a pendulum. And in this segment here we're about to play, he is describing the experience.
He was sitting in math class.
Our teacher handed us a little toy pendulum.
Basically just a little device with a ball on the end of a string.
That was retractable. That is, you could
change the length of the string.
Like an old telescope, you know, on that the pirate stretches out a spyglass, click, click, click. You could make it longer in discrete clicks. And then the teacher gave us a stopwatch and said, I want you to time how long it takes for this pendulum to swing back and forth 10 times. Okay, so I do the experiment. 10 swings. I record how many seconds it took. Then he says, now make the pendulum a little bit longer, one click longer. Click. Do it again.
And as you might expect, since now the string is longer, it takes a bit more time.
To make the 10 swings. And I write down the number. Click. Do it again. Click. Do it again. And I do this 5 or 6 times, dutifully plotting the results on graph paper, which is what the experiment was really supposed to teach us, how to use graph paper.
So he's clicking, measuring, making a little dot.
Click.
Measure. Dot.
Click.
Measure. Dot. Soon the thing is filled with dots, and that is when he noticed something.
This spooky thing was happening, which is that the dots were falling on an arc, on a curve.
Okay, so that's Season 5, Episode 5, The Wonder of Youth, featuring mathematician Steve Strogatz. And Jad and Robert, as I listen to that, the question that comes to mind is, you know, is the show part theater, part journalism, part art? How do you think of it, if you were to describe the show or put it into one category, if you could do that? You know, listening to that clip, hearing the music, the sound effects going along with it as he does the experiment, how would you categorize the show?
You don't know the half of it, because we then took that clip, gave it to a kid named Will Hoffman, who then made a video that is a precise and rather gorgeous version of the same story for the eye. So we did that too.
But I think the answer to your question is contained in the question. We are part art, part journalism, part theater, part story. Everything that you just said, we are an amalgam of all those things.
Yeah, and we wouldn't want to be less. I think, if anything, going forward, we'd want to be more.
Yeah.
I mean, what's happening in Salt Lake City this week is we are throwing ourselves in very richly, we hope, into a very theatrical mode where we are going to be dancing science stories and
just to be clear, Robert and I are not going to be dancing.
we have real dancers. You know, like the Palabolas Company is a really very
amazing
smart
dancers.
And we're going to be, you know, playing music. What we've discovered is that we are two people who can wonder out loud together, but we now know that we can have company. We can have Steve Strogatz wonder out loud with us, but he's informed, and it's his business. He's a teacher to wonder. It's kind of fascinating now that we can choose to ask dancers to wonder with us and rock and rollers to wonder with us and comedians to wonder with, because they have the same tools we do. They have as good brains in these particular cases. It's literally the case. And a different skill set called how to tell or how to interpret or how to handle knowledge of the world. You do it with your body, that's cool. You do it with your sense of humor, that's cool. You do it with your music sense, that's cool. You do it as journalists, that's cool. You do it in the film, that's cool. It's all cool. And I think the future belongs, I think, to a group of people, be they at the New York Times or at NBC or at Radiolab or wherever you want, that have that kind of dexterity, that can explain in all kinds of ways. Because I think you're going to find an audience that sometimes wants to listen, sometimes wants to watch, sometimes wants to go out on a date and spend time with you, sometimes wants to ignore you entirely. And you have to be there or not there and do it all the time. You have to be sort of tiptoeing around people. Now a good time?
Robert, I want to ask you, what kind of reaction have you gotten for the program from the scientists themselves? Scientists, of course, you know, not always the best communicators when it comes to describing their theories or their research, but of course this show makes it accessible to everybody. Have scientists weighed in on the show and said, you know, they're glad that you're doing this type of work?
Well, we haven't had a consortium. We haven't done a poll or anything. But it's interesting that when I call people and say, can you talk to us? I'm from this radio program. They not infrequently, they say, oh, yeah, sure. there is something We've had a few bumps and grinds, and there are some cultures. Israel, I'm preparing to do a talk in Israel. I've been warned that in Israel, the science community there is not particularly interested in talking to the mob, is very, very anxious about it being exactly so, and is suspicious of popular science, deeply so. So there, I'm told, I haven't had been there yet, so I don't know, I'm told I'm going to run into a fairly hostile environment. Here in America, I think scientists have now come pretty largely to the conclusion that not only is it valuable for them to be understood, that it's literally valuable. You can get more money and get more grants. If the subject that you're studying has a certain interest to the general public, there is gold in them in that.
I also think it's more primal. I mean, I think that most science involves an extreme amount of failure. But it's driven by something that sustains people through that incessant failure. And so people get into it because they're somehow fired up about whatever it is they're looking at. And it's an annoying thing to be so passionate about something, but to feel like you're locked in a cave and you can't share that. And so when we do, I think we approach people not as two guys who are like, we're going to take your research and dumb it down. No, that's not what we're after at all. We're trying to understand the thing that wakes them up in the morning, the passion that drives them. And that's the most exciting conversation you can have with anybody. So I think a lot of scientists are extremely excited because they understand maybe at this point our commitment to trying to know what it is that drives them.
And I think I also have a sense that freedom is involved. The institutions that practice science, or where science is practiced, have to be, generally speaking, pretty open-minded. You have to go where the data takes you. You have to go to wherever it is you must go in order to learn what you can call the truth, and that the truth is a universal truth. It has to be true in your country and on your planet and then everywhere in the universe. And there's something tough about that, but it means that people who do this for a living have to be free to explore. Now, there are governments and there are forces in the society that say, you know, shut up, please, or don't go there, or that's too dangerous, which is, by the way, a perfectly legitimate thing to say. Mm-hmm. Or the thing that you're thinking about frightens me and makes me worried for my belief system and my way of thinking about the universe and the things that make me feel special and safe and holy. And scientists have to learn how to respect the filters that people use when they look at science. And it's a delicate business, but it's also a serious business, and it's also, at the same time, a hard business, because you have to win your freedom every day. And storytelling is a big part of that. A scientist has to be able to say, well, you want to know how I think about this? Here's my story. And that story will go into competition against other stories, and you have to be good at it. And I think that's also important.
Let me ask you about the theme of your live shows Wednesday and Thursday this week at the Capitol Theater. It's Radio Lab in the Dark. Where does the in the dark come into play in the show here?
Yeah, I've been worried. You've been saying, well, so come to the show, it's in the dark. Like everyone's going to go into a closet and close the door. You won't see anything. We have lights in the dark.
It's true. It's the theme came from the genesis of the whole thing was that we were making a very different show once upon a time. I forget the topic, but included in our plans for that show was a particular story that Krulwich found about these two guys who had gone blind very separate times, very separate places. Mm-hmm. But they'd gone blind in the exact same way and had incredibly different experiences as blind men and had very different ideas about what it means to be blind, like what is the true way to be blind. And so Robert interviews them both, and then he got them together, and they just had a real, like, they went 10 rounds.
They had a rumble.
Tyson and the other guy who Tyson's bit his ear. What's that guy's name?
Holyfield, I think.
Holyfield, yeah. It was like a Tyson-Holyfield bout between these two blind guys. And it was a great story.
Not to mention how politically totally incorrect it was.
Yeah.
You have two handicapped people yelling, you're handicapped the wrong way.
Yeah. So we had this great story, and it was slotted into a different show. And somewhere around the way, I was like, you know, let's make this a show about the experience of darkness, being in the dark, because that can mean so many things. It can mean being literally in the dark, like the lights are off. And there are moments in the show where the lights are completely off. Mm. And it can also mean being figuratively in the dark, like people know things that I don't know, or I'm willfully ignoring the truth. And there are places in the show where we confront, you know, some of the sacred cows of creationism versus evolution and those kinds of things. And so, you know, it was an intoxicating phrase for us. It sort of opened a lot of doors. And we ended up, you know, basically following its lead.
Yeah, and it got more and more fun. So we thought, Chad saw this lecture in London where they have something called the Christmas Lecture, and it's for kids. And in it, someone decided to take on Charles Darwin's great worry, which is that how does he explain an eye to somebody who just, you know, wants to? How did an eye come to be? If it evolved, then you'd have to have something like a half of an eye or a quarter of an eye or a tenth or a thousandth of an eye. What would a thousandth of an eye do that anyone would want to keep it around? So he thought and worried about this. He knew that it was essential to his theory that he be able to explain convincingly that eyes evolved. And so we decided, just for the fun of it, to actually literally evolve an eye. And on the stage, you will watch the most primitive act of a living thing, which is catching light and holding on to it, growing into an eyeball.
Step by step by step.
Step by step.
Giant eyeball on the stage that we build right in front of you.
Yeah. And then now what you use an eyeball for, basically, is to think, can I eat that? Is that going to eat me? Or can I make a baby with it? Or at least have fun trying to make a baby. And the character that the eyeball inhabits is played by dancers, but the eyeball has personality. The prey have personality. It's very fun.
Yeah.
And you get to watch what the eye can see in front of you and all around you. It's very visual.
Yeah.
So there's that. Then, just because we can, we go into outer space and have a space adventure.
Yeah.
Totally in the dark. Except the dark suddenly becomes blazingly light, because this particular adventure is told by an American astronaut and his friend, a Russian astronaut. They're up in the Mir spacecraft, and they decide one night to go out and sit in the total dark. They're going to be traveling over the Pacific Ocean, and it's a night in which there's no moon up in their direction, and the Pacific Ocean is just empty of light. There's clouds over Honolulu, and there's no light at all. So they can put the Earth at their back, and the Earth is just a black cushion, like your parents' seat in the back of your car. And you can gaze deep into space at the only light that's left, which is all those stars and nebulae and gases. And that's what they're going to do. They're going to have a night out in the night. But they forget something, which, when you're 230 miles off the Earth, when the sun comes up, it doesn't come up gradually. It comes up, pew, like very fast. And they are totally, totally caught by surprise by the sunrise. And all hell breaks loose, as you'll see. It's very interesting what happens then.
That's coming up Wednesday and Thursday at the Capitol Theater. And Jada, one final question for you this morning before we must move on. But 2011, you were designated a MacArthur Fellow. This is commonly referred to as the Genius Award. I'm curious about what that has done for you personally, if it changes anything for the show or means anything in the future for Radiolab. How has that affected you?
We were joking yesterday that I would love to be able to walk into Danielle and get a reservation or something, because I'm now a quote genius. It hasn't really changed my life. I mean, it made my life really strange and trippy for a while, because it's a strange thing to get, and to suddenly get that call out of the blue. I mean, it's an amazing gift. I try to lord it over Robert, but he doesn't let me. But what does it mean for the show? I don't know what it means for the show. I still don't know what it means for me personally. I mean, it's an amazing thing, and we happen to be, regardless of the fellowship, we happen to be at a place with the show where we really are just trying to invent again, and the stage show is exactly that. So maybe this gives me a little bit, like a 6-inch higher platform to try new things. I'm not sure, but
this is when we go to bars, you know, and the guy says, "What do you like?" You know, the bartender.
Give me a genius special,
yeah,
please.
Right. What do I like? Let me think about that for a little bit too long.
What would Isaac Newton drink? Give me one of those.
In other words, it's obnoxious. But what can you do?
It's amazing, but it's been very weird. Good weird. But it hasn't really changed anything yet. But I'm hoping that we will, you know, next time we have this conversation, Radiolab may be an airlines and a sports show and perhaps a militia that will go in all kinds of new directions.
Right. Well, we look forward to that. My guests have been Jad Abumrad and Robert Krulwich, hosts of WNYC's Radio Lab. They'll be speaking tomorrow night at the Nature of Things Lecture Series at the Natural History Museum of Utah. Reservations are full for that, but you can catch the live broadcast right here on KCBW, or you could see them Wednesday and Thursday as they perform Radio Lab in the Dark. That's the name of the show at the Capitol Theater, and tickets for that are at arttix.org. Jad and Robert, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Hey, welcome. Thanks for having us.
And on Friday, we're going to be marching straight by you in strict militia form.
This is City Views on KCBW. We'll be right back.